ahead and take the speed up your number one now, runway 27 clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm Tom Charpentier, EAA Government Relations Director and one of your hosts. Across the way from me is...
I'm your other host. My name's Chris Henry, and I am the EAA Aviation Museum Director. And Tom, we're always lucky to have special guests, and today is no different. Today we actually have retired Lieutenant Colonel from the United States Air Force, John Duffy, here with us. John, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
And tonight, you're actually going to come up and speak at the museum. That's why you're here. Anybody that's listening, if you're in the area, we usually do third Thursday of the month. We have our museum speaker series. And tonight, we're eventually going to get to talk about flying helicopters in Vietnam, specifically the Jolly Green helicopter. But we're gonna talk a little bit about John's pathway into that. So, John, it's a question we always like to ask people on here, but what was the first thing that got you interested in wanting to fly?
Well, it was an unusual situation. My dad owned a big construction company, and I thought I was going to go into that. And there was another flap involved, but that didn't work out. So I joined the Air Force and hopefully go to pilot training. And that didn't work out. I had, at the time, the pilot training classes were all full. So I ended up having to go to navigator school. And after flying as a navigator for 5 years, I then went to pilot training.
Wow. What's hometown for you? Where were you born and raised?
Well, my hometown is Shaker Heights, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland. Actually, I was born in New Jersey, so don't hold that against me.
Are you a Browns fan? I got to ask as a Steelers fan here.
At the time, I was a Brown fan, and when I went to high school with two of Paul Brown's sons, Mike and Robin, and we played football together, so yes, I was a big Browns fan.
All right, so you joined the Air Force. What's your first impression of being in the Air Force? Where did you go, for example?
Well, first, I had to go through a cadet training program, which is they put you through a year of unpleasantries. But that wasn't a problem for me. I kind of took it in and just went along with whatever they had to do. And then I got commissioned in, 12, 13 months, whatever. And then at the same time, I got rated as a navigator. And then from that on, I had 5 years then to go before I could get to pilot training.
So what did you train in as a navigator, and then what did you serve in on the line?
Well, in the training as a navigator, part of the training of the navigator was a DC-3, but that was kind of minimal. I mean, that's how far back we went. We're talking, I joined the Air Force in 1954. I think you guys weren't even born by that time. So, and there was another aircraft that, it's been so long ago, I can't think of the name, but twin engine turboprop, and that was the primary trainer.
And so I don't know if we've actually ever, Chris, if we ever had a navigator on the podcast.
Yeah,
I know we're here to talk about helicopters ultimately, but so what type of techniques were you training on? Like, I had to imagine Celestial was still being taught at the time.
Yeah. Okay. Basically, that was all it was. Well, first of all, you had dead reckoning, which is time and distance from here to wherever you're going. And you had to maintain the right heading. And then you have to compensate. They teach you how to compensate for the wind and drift. So if the wind is pushing you that way, you turn the heading that way. So that was dead reckoning, basically what it was called. And then the primary navigation was Celestial.
Yeah.
Where you'd have a compass and you have a sextant, and then you take a shot at whatever body that you're looking at, and that will give you one line of position. But that, on a line of position, that doesn't do much good. So you take another shot and then have three shots total, and where they all circle to get together, that's where you are. And you do that it took 30 minutes to take a shot. So it was something that, initially, you thought, oh my God, I'll never be able to do this. But, after a while, it was pretty easy.
Were INSs in use at the time you were doing it?
Pardon?
Inertial navigation, was that becoming in use when you were a navigator?
Inertial navigation? I don't understand yet. No. It was not nothing like it at all.
Okay.
Wow. That's incredible.
Well, yeah. we did eventually, when I got into the KC-97s, we did have radar, but they didn't teach us radar in training.
Okay.
Because they didn't have them in the airplanes.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
So was the KC-97 that you mentioned, is that your first sort of assignment aircraft out on the line?
First as a crew member.
Wow, that's a heck of an airplane. What was your first sort of perception of it when you saw it in person?
Oh, my God, it's big. Because I'd been flying in little, twin-engine stuff, and then all of a sudden you walk out on the flight line and you go up and up. It seems to go forever.
It's like a double-decker B-29.
Yeah, right.
Wow. And obviously, for those that don't know, your primary mission on that was going to be mid-air refueling, correct?
That's correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about the missions you soon went on with what you were doing with the KC-97s?
Well, they were basically, we were part of SAC at the time, which is Strategic Air Command, which is no longer in being. But SAC had bombers and they had refueling aircraft, and they were the two that complemented each other. And the bombers couldn't go too far without refueling. And then we would refuel them and get them as far as they had to go. And then we'd meet them on the way back and refuel them so they could get back to base.
Wow. Can you talk about some of the missions we were talking about here to start with, for example, the B-47 missions?
Well, the B-47 mission, this was in the really cold part of the Cold War. And the Russians and the Americans were trying to figure out who had what. So this was before there were any really good satellites that could tell us where things were in that vicinity. So you take our B-47s, they take a B-47 and turn it into RB-47, which is reconnaissance. And they put in some really accurate cameras and a little better, the best navigation equipment they could have, which is not too great, but it was usable. And then we would refuel them, and then they'd come back out, and we'd have to refuel them quickly on the way back because they were low on fuel.
And you were saying it was really a dangerous mission for them because they weren't flying high altitude. They were flying lower to avoid.
They were evading Russian radar from start to finish.
Wow.
Yeah, this was, if I remember correctly, those are the missions that the U-2 was built to essentially take over.
That's
right?
Correct. The U-2 was a great improvement. This KC-97, it was a pressurized aircraft, but for that time, that was a big deal. And it could fly at, I guess, up to 30,000 feet, something like that. And you'd be pretty good, but the bombers at that time, they could go up 40-something thousand feet, and they also flew faster, and their stall speed was much higher. So, they'd have to push it when we were pushing our aircraft as high as we could to get up to, whatever, say 200 knots. And the bomber was trying to hang in there at 200 knots. That was a big difference.
And you mentioned that in all the time you refueled, there was only one that you ever sort of missed linking up with, right?
Yeah. And that was the only time we were refueling aircraft going into enemy territory. And it was just during this 3 or 4 months we were stationed in Greenland at Thule Air Base, which is north of the Arctic Circle. And so when we came out of there, then we were back to refueling local strategic aircraft going wherever they were going.
And you mentioned that it took you a while to find out what happened to the one airplane that you missed, right?
Well, I don't think many people knew how many aircraft and people we lost in the Cold War. It was never publicized. And I stumbled across this article in an Air Force document and was talking about losses, and there were a lot of losses. And then I happened to look at, and I kept my logs. In fact, I still have them, I think. And they looked at my log and looked at the date this aircraft didn't show up. And that was the one that was shot down. But it was never publicized that I know of.
Yeah. I think, you know, Francis Gary Powers obviously was a really, you know, big deal when he was shot down, but there were a lot of those B-47 crews were shot down, and you're right. It was just kept secret.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean, even the whole RB-47 program was really kept pretty quiet until years later.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And then you actually ended up going, where did you go next after Greenland?
Well, sometime, not immediately, but very quickly after that, we went from the top of the world to Saudi Arabia. And this was, the B-52s were sort of making an entry into the world of bombers. And to make sure that everybody knew we had the best bomber in the world, it was either 3 or 5 B-52s that they flew around the world without stopping. And so they needed tankers in order to refuel them. So we went from up here, no temperature down here, high temperature. And as it turned out, that worked out, not a problem. And we didn't lose anything to anybody that I know of anyway.
And then after that, at that point, is that when you were qualified to go through pilot training?
Well, no, it was, and after that Saudi Arabia trip was a fairly short one. We refueled and we got the bombers around the world. Then we went back to our local bases, wherever we happened to be stationed. And we'd be refueling SAC bombers. I mean, their normal training.
Wow. That had to be pretty interesting, though, to just be part of the Strategic Air Command.
Yeah, it was. Kurt LeMay, I think, was the commander at the time, and you don't want to mess with him.
So we've heard. Yeah. So tell us about going through pilot training. Where did you start? What type of aircraft did you start in?
Well, I started in a T-34, which would be a nice private if you had a private airplane, that would be good. It's a 2-seater, piston-driven, and it was easy to fly and fun to fly and safe. So, but from there, that was kind of a starter airplane. You need something more than that. So they went to that thing called the T-28, which is, and I went from the T-34 looking at the T-28, and that was up here. Big. And so we ended up transitioning to the T-28, and that was a great airplane. I enjoyed flying that.
Has a very distinct sound.
It has the sound of a John Deere tractor and idle.
Yeah.
And the way that, I was just thinking about that, as you idle the aircraft, you had to idle at 800 RPM or less. And that's when it made that noise.
Wow.
And if you had idled it more than that 800 RPM, they'd have to get it up to 1,000 or something to keep the flow of oil going through it. So that worked out pretty well.
That's wild.
And then after that, in fact, I just drove by a T-33 in the front yard here.
Yeah.
And flew the T-33. And when we got into that, that was more air refueling and a lot of formation flights and getting it to more practical fighter with fighter. And that was a good airplane. It had some idiosyncrasies. You couldn't advance the throttle fast. If you did, the engine would flame out, and that's not a good idea. but it was good training. You know?
Was it a hard transition from something like a T-28 to a jet, T-33?
No, I think it all went pretty smoothly. I didn't have any problem with them.
Wow. That's cool. That's a cool airplane. All those, that whole lineup there is pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
So then what's next? You decided to, or you got assigned helicopters.
Well, I really didn't want to go to jets. I just somehow, I didn't really care for that. But I did want to go to helicopters. And part of the reason for helicopters was they were old and they didn't have any good engines and they just needed help. So I thought I could get involved in working in the Air Force with helicopters to get them improved from where they were to where they needed to be. And by the time I got there, the turbine engines were in the choppers, and that was one of the great improvements. And then at the same time, the avionics started to get better. We never got as far, at that time, we never got as far as GPS, but eventually when I got to the H-53, we had good navigation. But still, there was no GPS. Eventually, we got it, but not then.
So tell me about the first helicopter you flew in the Air Force.
It's called an H-19. And it was a single engine, had a big, I say big, had a 600 horsepower engine, but the power to weight ratio was so bad. During the training, we went to, I was at Stead Air Force Base, and the elevation of the training field was 5,000 feet, and that altitude is pretty thin up there. And when the altitude is thin, air is thin, and this rotor bridge don't have a lot to dig into, and that makes them almost useless. But for the training flights, they put minimum fuel in the aircraft, and they'd have one pilot, one instructor pilot, and one student pilot. And you probably could fly for 45 minutes before you ran out of fuel. That's how critical it was. And then basically I learned after a short time, if you could figure out how to fly an H-19, you got the rest of the helicopter world locked in. So it worked.
It was a good trainer then.
It was, yeah.
So I think our audience might be a little curious about this. We hear so much about Army aviation and Army helicopters. We've had plenty of Army helicopter pilots on. Not so much with Air Force helicopters. So what is the mission of the helicopter in the Air Force?
Air rescue.
Air rescue.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
And the Army does air rescue, but it's more combat support, bringing troops in and troops out and evacuating the people that are shot up.
So basically about the troops on the ground versus pilots going down. That makes sense.
And the Army was very slow to teach their pilots how to fly instruments. And the Air Force, well, the fact that I went to fixed wing, you had to become a proficient instrument pilot. And as every time you flew, every 6 months, you took a proficiency check and you took an instrument check. And if you couldn't fly instruments, make instrument landings and so forth, you're just out of there. You couldn't retain your pilot status. So there are a lot of aircraft, not so much now. The Army is more involved in putting instrument training into the system, so that Army pilots are, I think, very well trained now. But at that time, they weren't. And people who haven't flown, if you get in, back when they first started flying with airmail and that kind of stuff, the pilots thought, well, I can fly through that cloud. And this guy that crashed and killed himself, he didn't know what he was doing. But you get in a cloud, and there's no way that you can stay straight and level. You could be going like that, and you think you're going like that. So, and if you don't have the instruments, you're out of luck. So.
Yeah.
Wow. So you go through your rotor training in the H-19. Do you immediately get the HH-53 after that?
No, I went into a helicopter called H-43, it was a step up. It had a turbine engine, and the power to weight ratio was really good. It could pick up a lot for the size of the engine and the aircraft. And it was called Local Base Rescue. And this was back in the time where the majority of aircraft that were lost were crashes on landing, and the old piston-driven airplanes, and they land and crash and burn. And this helicopter was supposed to be able to put out the fire before anybody got hurt, which was not the case. By that time, the aircraft that were being flown were mainly a new version of jets, and the jets didn't have that problem.
Did you end up doing? I'm just curious because I hear stories about this happening a lot. Did you end up doing any missions that involved rescuing or otherwise supporting like a civilian crash or somebody getting lost or something like that?
Anytime there was a problem, whether a civilian or enemy or whatever, we'd go do it. And that part of I had several assignments, but one assignment which was really interesting and good and made a lot of rescues was in Newfoundland.
Mm.
And the Newfoundlanders are really, really good people, but they do some silly things, and they frequently would fall off a cliff or out of a tree or something, and we go pick them up and drag them back to the hospital. And that was pretty common. Yeah.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit as what we're going to be talking about tonight, which is flying in Vietnam.
Yes.
So your mission in Vietnam was air rescue, to rescue downed pilots.
I was called a combat rescue crew commander, meaning we were flying in a hostile area.
Okay. And you flew the HH-3 and the 43, right?
Well, I flew the HH-3 maybe a couple hundred hours, but that was, I just picked up flights as they were available. But actually, we left the HH-43 a little too soon, if I can go back.
Yeah.
Sure.
The HH-43 was mainly built to put fires out on these aircraft that crashed. So we got our team together, and in order to practice, the base would have one area on the base where they burned fuel, and they'd start fires at these fuel pits, and we would take the H-43 and pick up a kit which is full of foam, and we had two or three members in the back who were firefighters. We'd fly the whole thing to where the fire was, and then we'd land, put the fire bottle down, let the firefighters get out, and then move forward. And with the helicopter, you take the helicopter up here and the flame here, and if the flame is like that, it's hard to put out. But if you put the rotor wash to it, it's down here, and now you can get to the base of the flame, and then you can put the fire out like that.
Huh.
And wow. I put out dozens of fake fires, but fortunately never any real fires.
Wow. Using the rotor wash to fan the flames out.
Yeah, the rotor wash got to where they flattened the flame out. And phew.
Wow.
And this foam bottle, it was really good. They could squirt the foam, I don't know how far, quite a ways.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah.
So we'll transition over to Vietnam. Where were you assigned at? Where were you based during Vietnam?
I was based at, before Vietnam, I had to get checked out on the H-53. And the H-53 was brand new to the Air Force. So I did most of my flight training with Sikorsky up in Connecticut. And then when I got my first assignment, we had a couple of different assignments. They changed the name a couple of times, but the final base I went to was called Udorn, U-D-U-R-N, or Udorn, like that. And that's was in Thailand. And in Thailand, I should have that map with me, but in Thailand, the next neighbor north was Laos, and that was neutral. Thailand was friendly. And then after Laos, you get into North Vietnam, and that's where our targets were. And the two main target areas, one was Hanoi, which was the capital of North Vietnam, and Haiphong, which is a port in North Vietnam. And we would we'd have three fighter missions every day, let's say like 10 and 1 and 3 or something, for the fighter aircraft to go in and hit certain targets. And we would follow those aircraft. And if the first flight was up to this here, we would be a safe distance from it. And so if he got shot down, we could be very close to where he probably would bail out. And we did that three times a day and ended up probably air refueling two or three times, depending on the wind and the missions and all that kind of stuff. So I spent the whole time at Udorn when I was in Vietnam.
So the a normal mission, what did that look like for you, a normal mission day?
Normal mission day, get up about 4 o'clock in the morning, find a little bit of breakfast, get to a briefing at about 6, and then the briefing would be the rescue people, the high-altitude radar people, that's a 121, and then we'd have 130 people who were, it was called King, and King was basically in support of everything down at the level of the refueling and picking people up. And then A-1 Sandy, which was a World War II fighter, that was an aircraft which was on our wing all the time. And so if anybody started shooting back at us, they wouldn't do it more than once. and that basically was what the force was.
So, and then there would be, how many helicopters would be in a flight?
That would be two. We'd have a what was called a high bird and a low bird. And the low bird was in charge of the flight. He would be the first guy to go in to make the pickup. And if something happened to him, then the high bird would take over. And he would go in, hopefully get everybody out.
I guess that was something I never realized. You know, I know that you guys flew up, you know, pretty far into North Vietnam to pick people up, but I didn't realize you were actually based at the same base as the fighters in Udorn.
Well, most of them came out of the same base,
yeah,
at Udorn. And
I know there were others too, but yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. And in some cases, major aircraft to do the fighting and then dropping bombs on the enemy, so to speak, was an F-4.
Yeah.
But there were some other aircraft, like F-102, which was not so good at it, but they had a few of those, and they were based someplace else. And there may have been one or two other fighters that I don't remember, but I know for sure that the F-4 was based right there in Udorn because I can't hear very well anymore.
So when you were and I guess we'll maybe talk about this a little more when we talk about, you know, the how a typical rescue would go, but how close were you actually getting to those target areas? Like how far from Hanoi would you guys go to pick somebody up?
Well, the rescue aircraft would not go very close because the further you got into Hanoi, Haiphong, they had a lot of ground firepower.
Yeah.
That SAMs, special surface-to-air missiles. And because of the 121 I talked about earlier, which was a high aircraft, and they were continually doing searches for MiGs and other aircraft or any kind of fire from the ground, they would tell us where not to go. And then once the fighters were in and made their attack on whatever the target was, we would pretty quickly know what the situation was, whether the fighters would get out or not, or whether the fighters, if they were going to get shot down, would land over here or maybe here. But we had radar from the 121s, and that's basically who we looked to decide where to go.
But still, they're going up there in an F-4 or an F-105, and you're going in there in a H-53. Yeah.
Well, and they paid a lot of attention to where we could and shouldn't go.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, we knew the terrain pretty well, so that helped. And then with the help of everybody else, the 130s and 121s, everybody, say, in fact, in the briefing we had early in the morning, I talked about brief at 6 o'clock, they said strike one is here and orbit area is here. A safe distance from the strike area. And for the second flight, the strike area is here and the orbit for choppers is here. And it's same with the third flight. And you do that, you know, a couple of times a week.
Was navigating in, was that difficult as far as looking out for maybe different challenges, both with terrain and any aircraft fire or anything like that?
Well, we knew pretty well where the permanent anti-aircraft fire is. Now, what you had to watch out for, and they were surface-to-air missiles, and they were pretty close to the targets, and we would keep track. And the 121 could tell when the surface-to-air missile was active or not. In fact, we could turn into a low frequency on one of our radios, and if you heard zip, 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 that means that the surface-to-air missile was searching.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And then if all of a sudden you heard zip, 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 that means he's tracking.
Yeah.
That means he's found a target. And you know, we don't know if it was us or not, but we took every precaution we could. If we were up here, we'd get the hell down in the weeds where they couldn't track us anymore.
You'd mentioned once in one of our chats, there was a mountain site that you never knew, like they would change if it was friendly or not throughout the week. There was like a hilltop site that you'd have to either give it a wide berth.
Yeah. That was a site was in Laos, and it was a pretty potent machine. It had radar, which was good, and excellent guns. And somehow that changed hands. Sometimes the Pakat Lao, the North Vietnamese, would be occupying that, and sometimes the Hmong would have it back again. So, but in any case, I made sure to stay way the hell away from that. and you couldn't go over it because it's got a better range. But you could, if you wanted to get really down, the capability for that site to lower its guns down, was not there. So technically, you could fly beneath the range of that gun, which I didn't do either. I flew big circle. and that seemed to work, but
wow.
So, as we're already starting to get down to the skinny end of the episode here. So I want to get into a little bit about how an actual rescue works. So, okay. So an F-4 is coming off the target and gets hit by an SA-2 and the air crew ejects. What happens next?
Well, and the 121, which is the high altitude aircraft, they would come up with a position as to where that aircraft was. And then eventually when the aircraft crashed, they could tell where it crashed, and they could tell pretty much where the survivor was then he punched out. And of course, they don't come to the same place as the aircraft crashed because he drifts around. So they ended up giving the information to King, which is the 130 on the ground. And then King, and we would be listening to all this at the same time. We had two or three different radios, and so we knew what was happening. So as soon as we heard that the aircraft was hit and was going to crash, we'd get information from whoever we could get it from, but mainly the 121. And we would head in that direction. At the same time, we had A-1s, which were World War II fighter airplanes, and they would support us almost any place we went. Any place you looked out, there's an A-1 and an A-1, and there are four of them. And they didn't leave us alone, which was nice. And ended up, we would stay, hopefully, the A-1s would take a pass over where the pilot landed or where he was, whatever happened. And they'd know it immediately whether there was ground fire because they'd be shooting at the A-1.
Got it.
And they didn't do that too much because once they shot at the A-1, the A-1 was pretty quick and that kind of went.
Go back in there.
Yeah.
And so when the A-1 said that the area was clear, then we were allowed to go in. And the guy on the ground that was a survivor had a radio and kept it in his flight suit. And as soon as he was on the ground, we could talk to him and he'd talk to us and he would tell us he's on the ground and he's not hurt and there's no enemy fire that he could see. And then we could push a button and the button would point directly to his radar, to his radio.
Oh, okay. So you had like an ADF.
We wouldn't know how to get from there to there. And in the meantime, if we're here and this guy is over here, but in the middle there was some bad guys, then the A-1s would say, don't go that way, go this way. You know, don't go that way. So the A-1s were looking for us to keep us out of trouble as much as possible.
What if you weren't in communication with the pilot? Like what if the pilot was hurt or something, but you still had their beeper going off? Would you still go in or?
Yeah. Well, I had five people on my crew and couldn't afford. That's a hard question. Always a hard question.
Sure.
You never know if I'm going to go in. Am I going to get shot down the first 100 yards or what? But so the question comes up from the Sandys, who are hopefully making it peaceful down there, saying, well, it looks like you're probably okay. And that's okay. If he says that, then we'd go in and go in fast and pick the guy up. So it all depends on the situation.
Sure.
Now, would you usually send like a PJ down on a cable or something to pick the gentleman up with the...
Only when it's necessary.
Okay.
And mainly, if survivor's here and you're on top of him, you want to be there instantly, get out.
Yeah. Right.
So you come in and so if you send a pararescue guy down, it takes time to get him down and it takes time to get him back up again. But if the person on the ground is incapacitated, then we'll spend whatever time it takes. and we'll send a PJ down. Sometimes we'll send a FARS penetrator down, which is a device, if the trees are heavy and you can't get through with a basket, send FARS penetrator down. And FARS penetrator can hold two people. So the pararescue guy would be one person going down. And then when he gets on the ground, he'd assess the situation with the receiver or the guy that was shot down. And then from there, assuming he was okay, they'd hook him up to the FARS penetrator and bring them all up and get out of there. Now, if the situation was such that the survivor was not in good shape, maybe he couldn't move, maybe he's not conscious, then we'd have to send a basket down. And the basket, you know, it's like, well, if you laid yourself out like it's on the table here, and it's pretty narrow, you put the guy in the basket. But to get the basket down, instead of letting the basket go down this way, we'd hold it from one end, and it go down through the trees and bushes. And then with that is the pararescue guy. So when they got on the ground, they could lay the basket out, put the guy in the basket. And then the pararescue guy has to move the trees and the bushes away as they come back up again.
Wow.
And so you're hanging up there hoping everything's going to work out. But every situation is totally different, as you can imagine, I think.
Sure. Wow.
Yeah.
And your helicopter wasn't necessarily a sitting duck. You had some ways to fire back at the enemy too, right?
We had fantastic miniguns. We had three miniguns on each aircraft, one out the left, one out the right, and one out the tail. The whole tail back end of that 53 came down just like it was like this, and then and out the back. So they got pretty good coverage back here. And we make sure that the miniguns, and you could fire 2,000, 4,000, or 6,000 rounds per minute. And we backed everything off to 2,000 rounds. Otherwise, we'd have no ammunition left, or we couldn't carry enough ammunition. So anyway, but when you fire a minigun, it has every fifth bullet is incendiary. So when you pull a trigger, you don't have to aim like you do a rifle. You can see the red bullets going on like that. It's kind of like using a garden hose. You know, you see where the water's going, and that's where you aim the hose. So.
Wow.
So that was exceptional. Hmm. And on top of that, the A1s.
Yeah.
Were there.
Did you ever fly an aircraft or a mission where you found out afterwards that you did take some hits from the enemy?
Yeah, I never took any big hits, but small hits, probably from ground fire mainly, we took some. But on the other hand, the H-53 was well armored. We had armor plate around the engines, although I know in one case where a small bullet went through the armor, somehow got into the engine. There's a picture. We have it. You'll probably see that. So in order to keep yourself safe, you sit in the cockpit, and the cockpit was all metal, bulletproof. And then just as you got into the cockpit and get your seatbelt on, you put a thing in front of you called the Iron Maiden, which was just covers the front of your body, and it would take a hit. I'm not sure what size bullet, but yeah.
Wow.
So and normally you wouldn't have the Iron Maiden on until you got into a combat situation, and then with the guys down there, okay, and then there's a checklist what you do before you go in to make a pickup, and one of the things is put that Iron Maiden on.
Wow. And it sounds like you never really had a chance to talk much with the people you picked up. Is that correct?
Almost in Vietnam, never. And even in the civilian world, when people were hurt and we picked them up, I was flying an airplane, but the main thing was to get the person the medical help in most cases. And sometimes if it'd be an ambulance right there, they'd pick them up and take them to the hospital. Or sometimes we could fly them right to the hospital, but then they go in the hospital and lock the doors. And so,
yeah. Wow.
So I met a couple of people in Newfoundland who were civilians. And after this one young high school girl, I'm not sure how old she was, but she fell off a cliff and broke her leg. And sometime after that, I got a note from her. And I had 12 people working for me who were newfies in Newfoundland as crew members. So somehow they got a hold of guys that worked for me, and I got this one note, but that, I never did see people that we picked up.
Wow. That's
which incredible. Is fine. They're good. That's what counts.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. John, we could have easily have a part two. I know we're fighting the clock here to wrap up, but on behalf of all of us, we want to say thank you for coming out. Thank you for what you did in the service, and thank you for what you did in Vietnam. We're just very proud and honored to spend the evening with you here, and definitely want to say thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Yeah. It's amazing how quickly our time goes here when we're doing these. So.
Yeah. And you've had such a varied career that, we could probably have turned this into two or three episodes, I'm sure. But thank you so much for coming out. I'm sure it'll be a fantastic talk tonight. Certainly on behalf of the air crews that you, the many air crews that you saved and their families, we'll say thank you even if they weren't able to.
Have you got one more, a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
We're talking about 1:30. Well, they were fantastic. And I was coming back from a mission up north, and as far as I know, I didn't take any hits. But at one point, I got to the point when my fuel level was going down much faster than it normally would. So I called Saigon, which is headquarters rescue, and I said, "Saigon, this is Jelly 10. I'm running low on fuel. I need a 53 here, quick." And they waited, I don't know, seemed like forever. And he came back and he said, "We can't send anybody up there. There are too many MiGs in the area." So I clicked, and almost instantly, I got a call from a C-130 pilot. And the pilot said, "I didn't hear that information from Saigon. I'll be up this way, and you come down this way."
Wow.
and he came up, and we went down, and we tried to plug into him, but my boom wouldn't extend. But I finally got plugged in, and he took us all the way back to Udorn, right there in formation.
And, wow.
But he never heard Saigon. And, you know, that recently there's been some talk about if you're given a command or an order, do you do it or not? It has to do with the boats that are sinking in the Caribbean. So, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the rescuing goes all around.
Yes, it does.
It does. In the military. So thank you so much for being on. Thanks again, Chris, for being our your erstwhile co-host here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, thank you, John, for coming and for being our speaker tonight.
My pleasure.
Yeah. As Chris said, if you're in the Oshkosh area ever on what is it, Chris, the third Thursday of the month?
Typically the third Thursday.
Definitely check our lineup for speakers. We do pretty much every month except July when we're a little busy, and I believe December because of the holidays,
yes,
correct?
Yeah. We have our Wright Brothers banquet then. Yeah.
Every month at what time?
7 o'clock on the third Thursday of every month.
Third Thursday of every month.
Yes, sir.
And Chris has always put together a fantastic slate of speakers, many of whom you've heard on the Green Dot and will continue to hear. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for sending your reviews in to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll catch you next time when you are cleared to land on the Green Dot.